chapter 8, we will be exploring kind of the origins of Hanukkah and what it was about. And I have a quick video, and it's why I want to hustle through this. And I don't want to hustle into short shrift. I just want to, this could be a super duper history lesson, which is something I really like. So I got to be careful about it becoming, me becoming a history teacher. So we're going to go through this. What's interesting about this chapter in the Bible is Daniel gets it explained to him. There's no kind of questions in some parts of it is what it is. So this is, I left the title on this one. This one is definitely Daniel's vision of the ram and the goat. So we're going to go through that. You'll see it's kind of an interesting twist. And quick side note, chapters 1 through 6 were historical, and we kind of went through them in chronological order. The visions are not in chronological order. They're in an order that the Holy Spirit put them in for whatever reason that was done. Because as you can see, this will be in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, which was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. So we kind of are way past that in the chronological thing. We're already up to the Medes and the Persians. And here we're going back to the Babylonian times when Daniel's under the Babylonian rules and system. So, verse 1, with that, all that being said, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. So, Daniel's kind of verse 2. And I saw the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the capital, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. I have no idea why we're given so much detail into where Daniel is. This particular.
Do you know where this is? Because Belshazzar didn't seem to know Daniel, so maybe he's not.
Yeah. So maybe this is why he's off doing. Because actually, what I was going to tell you, Susa is a capital. Elam used to be its own little mini empire that was eventually conquered. So it's on the side of the picture, Judah over here. You kind of go up to this point around the Red Sea, and then the Euphrates and the river feeds in there. And then on the other side of that, the opposite side of that, was the kingdom of Elam, of which was conquered, and Susa was its capital. And this canal evidently separated the capital city from the rest. It was like a defensive thing almost, like a moat kind of thing. So why we're given that bit of information, I couldn't figure out. I tried to, like, get behind and see something. But obviously it's there for a reason. I don't know what it is. Maybe someday in the future this will come into play. I don't know. Verse 3. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one horn was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward, northward, and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. As I was considering, behold, a male goat from the west came across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. So I'll kind of stop there. So basically what this is talking about, you understand that the ram was actually the symbol of the Babylonian Empire. The Medes and the Persians. So that's why it has two horns. So again, we go back to this reference to the two parts of this kingdom, the Medes and the Persians, and eventually one horn becomes greater, which the Medes kind of fall off, and it becomes basically the Persian Empire is what it's pretty much known now. And he kind of conquered, and as we saw with Nebuchadnezzar, he said, you know, the Lord gave you the power of death and who you decided to live, lived, and who you decided to die, died, that kind of thing. So then we're introduced to this new character, the male goat, and he only had one horn. And so we're going to kind of see. So it's funny, I was watching It's a Wonderful Life last night, and they actually put a goat in the back of the car because I was thinking. So in reality, in human terms, the goat should have been in no way able to contend with a ram. If you've ever seen, you know, we've all seen the National Geographics where the rams slam their horns together, and, you know, the goat's a much smaller animal. And then for the goat to have one horn, it's kind of interesting. But we're going to kind of get introduced to that horn. He's going to become very important. So verse 6, he came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him with his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him, and there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. So basically what you're seeing here, not to give away the storyline in this, is Alexander the Great, believe it or not, the symbol of Greece. Well, he was actually, it's funny because it's called the Greek, he was a Greek conqueror. He was really from Macedonia, which, if you know anything about Greek history, they were very city-centered. Like, Athens didn't always get along with Sparta, which always didn't get along with Macedonia. So they warred among themselves constantly. So Alexander was a general from Macedonia. And the symbol for Macedonia was, believe it or not, a goat. And it's even in the zodiac. I believe Aries, is it Aries? One of them means goat. I've looked that up for you, but just as a side note. So that metaphor is kind of carried through a couple different, even secular kind of things. So, and if you know anything about your history, you know, Alexander the Great was really, so a quick step back, not to be the history lesson. We've all seen, not all, you've probably seen the movie The 300. It was basically Xerxes attacked Greece. And basically what the Spartans did, they let him come ashore, and then they met him at Thermopylae, where you had to go through this really narrow pass, and 10 Spartans could take on 100 of the Persians because they had to filter through this pass and they almost had to come through single file. So they decimated them for a long time before they found their way around. And eventually they did some damage, but because of the amount of damage inflicted to them at the Battle of the 300 in Thermopylae, and then their ships were wrecked during a storm, it's like 300 ships. Xerxes traveled with an army at that time of 350,000 men, it was estimated, which was huge. And by the time he left, he had like a third of that amount when he went back. But this so enraged the Greeks that eventually, when Alexander came to power, he vowed to avenge his father who had fought in that battle. So that's kind of like, so he goes off, and by the time he goes off to tackle the Persian Empire, Darius is ruling. So, if you know your history, twice Darius fought against Alexander the Great and lost. And Alexander was way outnumbered, but he was like a military genius if you look at some of what he did in battle. So, verse 8, then the goat, Alexander, became exceedingly great. But when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. So we'll stop there, and you got to think, and I can't believe it hasn't switched yet, that, there it is, we are seeing something that hasn't even happened yet. For us, it's kind of looking back, and we kind of forget. But Daniel's seeing all this, and he's still in the Babylonian Empire. These people haven't even come to, neither one of them have come into existence yet. So this is how far, and again, I wanted you to see, and I'll do it up here real quick before you. So this, the green part here, this basically is Alexander's brother-in-law. This guy married Alexander's wife. So basically, Alexander dies. He says, they say to him, so who gets the kingdom? And this could be folklore or whatever. Supposedly says, let the strongest have it. So his four generals, or they say generals, but this guy was more of a counselor. He became his brother-in-law. He was married to his sister. So he basically says, hey, I'm just happy to take this little place. I'm going home to my wife and hang out around home. So the other three guys, one guy gets what's today is kind of Turkey, a little bit into Asia Minor, Europe, right here. That's the tan line. But the two biggest ones would be Ptolemy takes this, and Seleucus takes a huge, because he was basically a contemporary of Alexander. They went to school together. They were friends. They were all that. Well, as you can see, and it's kind of funny how this map does it. They surround Judea with blue, but it also has the yellow from the Seleucid Empire. So this is what we're going to deal with today. And you're going to see this is the next, what we call the silent years between the old Malachi and Matthew. They say, well, they're silent years. So God, well, but God's like, I already told you about it. I don't even talk about it anymore. This is what we're going to learn about today. These 400 years is this right here. So I would have used my pointer, but it's so slow. So that's what works. So I wanted you to see the map so you have that in your mind when we go through this, how. And then I'm hoping to get to a video that explains a lot more. All right, so out of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. Well, that is, the glorious land is a word for Israel. So one guy that we're going to, out of these four guys, another guy comes up. And you got to be careful because I know we saw in the other thing about there was a horns back in chapter 7, but that was Roman. And all this, we're going to, it's just the Greeks. And again, you know, all this, you're seeing man and Satan do all these things to play against God. But the plan is playing right into God's hands in that, although we will see how bad the Hellenization was for the Jews to an extent, but the Lord was also preparing the whole world that was divided into all these kingdoms, now is going to have one language. And it just so happens that that language has to be one of the languages that the New Testament was translated into. So the Lord's preparing for the church to conquer the world, basically, in this. Or at least you can make that case. So verse 10, it grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the hosts and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. This is a kind of an interesting, you can go through all the different commentaries. I'm sorry that doesn't keep up. But what happened here, some people believe, and I would kind of lean more towards this, if everybody's read Ezekiel 14 and Isaiah 7, or do I have that backwards? Anyway, where the prophet starts, at one point he's talking about the king of Tyre. And he's saying, you know, you did this and you did this. And then all of a sudden he says, you were in the Garden of Eden. You were in this. You did this. So we see a case where it's being talked about a person in existence right now and a thing, but it rips open a veil a little bit and you see what's behind that and what's kind of driving that force. Because we will see, you know, one point Daniel, we all know he's praying, and an angel kind of comes in. He says, "Hey, man, the angel from the you know was against me, and he's from an empire that doesn't even exist yet." So we can kind of see behind all these empires is a unseen hand driving these empires to do some of the things that they did. So that's where this and some of the hosts of the stars and the threw down the ground and trampled. You can make a case that this is just the people in Israel, that they're about to be really, they're in the middle of this and they're going to be trampled on and killed and their leadership is going to be killed. And you can make that, obviously, throughout the Bible, the stars of heaven are angels, that there's a case where we see that Satan drags some angels out of heaven with him, and they're led to destruction. So it's talking again about this horn. And it became great, and even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. Here most people believe he's talking about the high priest of Israel. And we're going to see in the video, but not to go into a history lesson again, because the video explains it much better than I can. Eventually, part of the Hellenization effort of the Greeks were you could not circumcise your kids. They took away the Sabbath. They sacrificed animals on the altars that were not, that were unclean. They basically did everything they could to poke their eye in what they considered the Jews' face, but it was actually poking their eye in God's face, poking their finger in God's eye. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spake, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate and given over of the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state. I don't know if anybody ever looked at exactly how long from, I guess, the time this started till what we're going to see as Hanukkah is what changes this, that this is basically 6.8 years if you look it up in a 360-day calendar. I don't know the significance of it. I don't know if anybody ever said, you know, from this date exactly till this date exactly was when the temple was purified again. I don't know. I couldn't find anything on that. But here the Bible's pretty, I'll bet if somebody was smart enough to look into that, that you would see that that is what happened. So I dug this up out of the Britannica.com, the little bit at the bottom. And the Seleucid Empire was a major center of the Hellenistic culture, which maintained the preeminence of Greek customs and manners over the indigenous cultures of the Medes. So you understand this is a complete change from what happened before. With the Medes and the Persians and the Babylonians, when they conquered you, they took your best people and said, "Hey, bring all that good stuff over here. We could probably learn some stuff from them." You're going to, the Greeks say, "Nah, we got this. We know everything. Just, you're going to be like us. We're not going to learn anything from you." So a Greek-speaking Macedonian aristocrat class dominated the Seleucid state throughout its history. Obviously, since Alexander the Great came from Macedonia, you see that, why that. Although this dominance was most strongly felt in the urban areas, resistance to Greek culture hegemony peaked during the reign of Antiochus the Fourth. So Antiochus the Fifth, or Third, was his father, was Antiochus the Great. This will be, Antiochus is called Epiphany, which means, if we know, if we have an epiphany, that he means the great one, or the highest level. But he got the name, you could bend the name a little bit, and we'll see it in the video, and it means the crazy one. So that's how the Jews referred to him. So, and his promotion of Jews, of Greek culture, culminated in his raising a statue to Zeus in the temple at Jerusalem. So this is what's called the Abomination of Desolation. So that's why it's going to be important, because understand that Jesus said, in the future, there's going to be an abomination of desolation. So this is where you get your definition. Again, our culture says, you speak something, it comes true, that's prophecy. Jewish culture is more you have a model, and that model models for you what the future is going to hold. So we saw that with Boaz with the kinsman redeemer and all those kind of things. So that's kind of way that's the kind of way this is played out for this abomination of desolation. He had previously ordered the Jews to build shrines to idols and sacrifice pigs and other unclean animals and had forbidden circumcision, essentially prohibiting, on pain of death, the practice of Jewish law. The persecution of the Jews and the desecration of the temple sparked the Maccabean uprising, beginning in 165, a quarter century of Maccabean resistance, ended with the final wresting of control over Judea from the seculars and the creation of an independent Judea in what now is called Palestine. I had to add that because they just put it in there. So, we don't have to listen to what Chris thinks about all this because the Bible's going to tell us. When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it, and behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Euphrates, and it called, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood. So, again, some people, different things, I don't know how important it is. I think the number of verse 15 is of the Christophany, appearance of Christ. And if every time you are introduced to Gabriel, he's bringing news about what the Lord's going to do. That's, you never see, he's not really anybody you see in the fighting and all that, which I don't know if he can or not. I'm not going to, you know, question his abilities. But he always seems to be the one bringing and explaining things. He's the one who came to Mary with Gabriel. So he's always bringing news, which would be the definition of an angel. And so he came there where I stood. And when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end. So you can see. So it's kind of interesting. And again, this is happens throughout the whole Bible. Whenever an angel appears and people realize if he's not in his manly appearance, he scares the you know what out of people, and they end up falling on their face. And a bunch of times when they fall on their face, the angels say, hey man, get up, you're going to get both of us in trouble, because we know an angel that wanted to be worshipped, and that's what led to his downfall. But he touched me and made me stand up, and he said, behold, I will make known to you what shall be in the later end of the indignation, for it refers to an appointed time of the end. As for the ram you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia, and the goat is the king of Greece. Remember this, these don't exist when he's talking to Daniel. Neither one of these kingdoms has existed yet. So it has to be really interesting. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for that horn that was broken, in the place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from this nation, but not with his power. As we can see, once it's divided up, they kind of fight amongst each other, and the Greek Empire doesn't ever expand to where it was under Alexander. And at the latter end of their kingdoms, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. He shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. Again, we go back to the destruction of the saints, which I argue is could mean, would to me mean that there's different sets of saints, because Jesus basically stood on Mount Hermon and said, this is my church and nothing will overcome my church. So you can do with that what you want. And in verse 25, by his cunning he shall make the deceit prosper under his hand, and his own mind he shall become great. Without warning he shall destroy many, and he shall enter he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. So again, this goes back to the same Ezekiel, Isaiah kind of thing, where it happens, we're going to see Antiochus Epiphanes, what he does, and what he does to the temple, and what he does to the Jews, and what he does to all this. But you get the feeling that this is bringing forth a character who's going to be just like him, but in a greater extent in the later days. And he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, would be directly against one of the defining terms of Jesus as the prince of princes. So this person's going to rise up against Christ himself, and he shall be broken, but with no human hand. Says that, and you'll see at the end of this, I go into Revelation to kind of bring some a different perspective to this. The vision of the evenings and the vision of the evenings and the morning that has been told is true, but seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now. And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it. So again, we see, we saw last week Daniel said, you know, he basically turned white as if he'd seen a ghost. Today he's just like, I'm just sick. But I went and did my job, but I just felt sick because of what I had seen and what the future and how violent and terrible the future is. Because you got to remember, Daniel's praying because he thinks the Jews are going to go back to Israel and it's going to kind of be restored. I got that. You get that feeling from him that, okay, we've paid our price. We're going to go back and things are going to get better. And basically the vision said, no, that's not going to be what happens. So that had to be kind of a blow to. So I went into Revelation chapter 13, and this is kind of the same. You're going to get a definition of this guy a little deeper. Or what we've seen over the last 2 weeks, you'll see this kind of play out in Revelation 13. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads and with diadems and on its horn and blasphemous names on its head. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Remember, that was one of the definitions of Alexander the Great. Its feet were like a bear's, so that's, you go back to the Medes and the Persians, that's how they were defined, and its mouth was like that of a lion, all the way back to Babylon. So it's actually going backwards in time, because we're in front of it looking back. And to it, the dragon gave his power, his throne, and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who could fight against it? If you go back to what we were just reading, it says this guy became great, but it wasn't in his own power. He was given that power. And here it's describing, again, it's not describing the same, it's kind of describing the same thing, but it's also describing a future event with the same players. Same type of players, I should say. And the, verse 5, and the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. Again, that's always the big 42 months, 3.5 years. It's always half of the 7 year, what we call the tribulation. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name, and his dwelling, that is, and those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. Anyone who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword he must be slain. Here is a call for endurance and the faith of the saints. So we kind of see that same scenario playing out again. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth, had 2 horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It's kind of an interesting metaphor that it looks like this soft, loving, cuddly thing, but that it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. and by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, which is amazing, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. And you could spend hours going into, like, this reanimation. Is it really talking? Is this like the Max Headroom thing? I have to show my age back, where you can make this thing, you can automate it with, you know, computer AI stuff. Or is it really just talking? Is it really come to life? Is it really animated? And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Again, back to the guy we just talked about and what he did to the Jews. Same basic thing. It also causes all, both great, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or on the forehead. And again, a lot of people looking at some of this, it's because his eye, he says he has a hurt arm and a blinded eye, that people, this is a way to say, to state your allegiance to this reanimated beast. And, you know, I don't think you'll be tricked. Anybody could be tricked into doing this. I think those that do this will be doing it out of adulation, out of worship, not tricked into doing this. So that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of his name. This calls for wisdom. Let one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and the number is 666. And that is, I have no idea. You could go through a billion different things. I mean, growing up in the 80s with the metal band, everybody had to have 666 on their, you know, album cover for whatever reason. It's going to be kind of interesting that it probably doesn't even mean what we think it means. And it probably isn't even close to what we think it means. So, but I have no idea. So if you're looking to me for answers about the 666, I don't think anybody knows. I don't know if you go back in Hebrew and look at the symbol for six, and people have said, you know, people, we are three, spirit, soul, and body, that seven's perfection, so this is just falling short of perfection. That's why it's the number of a man in those three. Your guess is as good as mine. I have no idea. So I know that was a little bit rushed, but there wasn't much there other than kind of a history lesson. So I wanted, Scott, can you start the? So I think this is about 12 minutes, which will work out pretty close to.
That was my reasoning, and I was going to ask, referencing back to what you read, so it's funny that you read it in complimentary, because do you think the beast and the dragon, because the beast is like more referred to as kingdom,
in Daniel, I know you don't know the answer, none of us know the answer. Do you think the beast and the dragon are more nation-like represented versus an individual?
I don't know. I get the feeling it's an individual, to be honest with you, but the nations coalesce. But like, since like the goat was referred to as a...
But that was a person. He was a king of that. It was Alexander.
Then what was the
Medes
called?
That was the ram, because it had two horns, the Medes and the Persians.
All right.
So that was Darius.
More of an individual
one.
Versus.
Well, it's every...
Like I said, I know we don't
want to
answer. Yeah, I don't... Celebration of the festival.
You could make it the full screen thing. So I thought you might like this on the... For those of you that weren't here, I was like making fun of Hanukkah, but it's that we used to take with like squabs or whatever, but really it is. Jesus solidifies the promise.
When the descendants of Alexander the Great
I found it.
In the land of Judea and tell a story of the ancient Jewish people's struggle to win liberty against the forehead of the Hellenic world. Our sponsors allow us to release videos regularly without
sorry. Commercial.
Shout out to Supremacy 1914, the sponsor of this video. Supremacy 1914 is a free online DVD style game, a rarity, and a huge
deal.
In Supremacy 1914, you lead a real country during World War II. By the era of classical antiquity, the independent kingdoms of Israel and Judah were in terminal decline. As a result, the history of the Jewish people soon came to be defined by the carousel of foreign empires that took turns conquering and subsequently ruling the ancestral Hebrew homeland. First came the Assyrians, then the Babylonians, then the Persians, who ruled the Jews with a reasonably fair and light hand. Finally, in 332 BC, the Macedonian sciences of Alexander would steamroll the Achaemenid Empire out of existence, establishing classical Greek as the dominant language and culture of the Near East. It is here that the Jewish people became subjects of the Greek world. When Alexander died, his massive Macedonian Empire fractured into several monarchies, ruled by his closest comrades and later their descendants. The so-called Diadochic kingdoms were constantly at war with one another, and the region of Judea, being situated in the borderland between the Ptolemies of Egypt and Seleucids of Syria, became a battleground